Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And so the biographers say things like the early days of his marriage were the happiest of his life. Conditions were idyllic. And that's when I think the penny dropped for me and I just thought, well, conditions were idyllic is the passive voice. Someone was making those conditions and she was working really hard to make them. And when I then started to reread the biographies with this passive voice in mind, every time something was put in the passive, the baby was collected, the visas were obtained, I was absolutely on the alert to think which woman at what cost has done this thing.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
There are some books that have to be talked about as you read them and for months, years after. They need to be passed around and bought for friends. They go down as a phenomenon themselves. And they're used to explain a broader theme that might be happening around the people who are reading them. Wifedom by the multi-award-winning author Anna Funder is one such book. The president of Chief Executive Women and an Australian equity advocate, Sam Mostyn, bought me a copy of Anna's book from a Paris bookstore, Shakespeare and Co., when she was visiting in Paris. We'd never met before, but essentially we got together to talk about wifedom. We spent an evening talking about the themes in the book. Two Australian women in their 50s in a cafe in Paris late last year. I finished reading it camping in outback Australia over Christmas and I gave my copy to my sister-in-law who's since passed it on to someone else. I think a lot of women have a similar relationship with this book, which came out in the second half of last year. Wifedom uncovers the role of the wife of George Orwell, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, Orwell, of course, being the author of 1984 and Animal Farm and a host of other history-defining books. It looked at the role she played in the ideation, the writing of and publishing of Orwell's books, and in the general enabling of his career, and then at the way she was essentially written out of history by both Orwell and his many, many male biographers. Anna then rewrites Eileen back into history via a literary technique that has confounded many critics, but has led many fellow writers to describe it as a masterpiece. Previously a human rights lawyer in the Australian government, Anna has always written about power. She took on the Stasi in her book Stasiland, which went on to win the UK's Premier Award for Nonfiction, the Samuel Johnson Prize, and is currently being made into a TV series starring Elizabeth Debicki, and which, by the way, Tom Hanks described as fascinating, entertaining, hilarious, horrifying, and very important. She's also taken on the Nazis in All That I Am, which won the Miles Franklin Award. In Wifedom, she squarely tackles patriarchy and all of its hypocrisies. And in this chat, recorded at Work Club Global in Sydney, it's kind of an upscaled, kind of we work with a conscience, if that makes sense. We cover how it continues, this is the patriarchy, to silence many women today as they facilitate the success of their husbands and partners from the shadows. We also cover how doublethink, which of course was a term coined by Orwell in 1984, to describe a particularly dark and destructive indoctrination technique, was used by Orwell himself with his wife and his relationship with women more broadly, and continues to be used so seductively today. At the end of our conversation, we branch out into a fun chat about Australia and how women often tend to write books. And this often involves, for some reason, a lot of footnotes. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So wonderful to have you here talking with me in real life, because we've got so many kind of connections, friends of friends, and I've heard you brought up, and I've had friends tell me, oh, you must meet my friend Anna. Like, it's just, it's, you know, it would be a worthwhile thing for you to do. So thank you so much for joining me here on Wild.
Such a pleasure, Sarah. I've had exactly the same thing. You've got to meet her. Don't you know her? You must know her. You must meet her. So it's very nice to be here today.
I am a big fan of your work, but in particular as a writer, I observe the way that you insert yourself into your books and you take a real responsibility for the way that you present your books, particularly these themes about power. And in this book, your latest book, Wifedom, you bring your own story into it, your story as a wife and as a writer. And it's one of many threads that you weave throughout the book into Eileen O'Shaughnessy's story. And I love how you come to describe at the beginning of the book how you actually came to write this book. And you describe being in a shopping mall, trapped in your own quote-unquote motherlode of wifedom. And you figured it would be a great idea to turn to the works of George Orwell to find some answers. Can you describe to listeners how that then led you to write this particular story?
Yes. Every time I talk about this, it sounds like I realised my situation and then I formulated a plan and then I acted according to the plan. So it sort of gives me, my hindsight gives people the illusion that I knew what I was doing, which I didn't. I think...
What writer ever does?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So writing is really like making the tightrope that you are walking on. You don't know if it's going to hold you up and you don't know if there's another end that it's going to attach to. But yeah, I did have this kind of privileged perimenopausal meltdown in a really ugly but shopping mall, which I'm in all the time, and I kind of love in a very S&M type of relationship I have with the shopping mall over 20 years. But yeah, I was pushing this full trolley of vegetables and groceries and dragging a depressed French exchange student, and I had three kids who were, two of them were going to different new schools, and it was February, so it's the time of year where you have to get massive amounts of organisation done. I had a deadline on a film project that was being made from one of my books. I had to do writing on the script. I had to get someone to pay someone to help me. But it was a sort of like what's happened to my life moment. So instead of going home and unpacking the groceries, I went around the corner, as I describe in Wifedom, and into a secondhand bookshop, which I really love, and found a lot of things that I do happen by serendipity, and I kind of, it's too much to say I believe in serendipity, but some things sort of present themselves to you, and if they have a special charge of meaning at that moment, you don't necessarily know why, but you will discover it. And that was the case when I saw this collected edition of Orwell's letters, journalism and essays. And I just sort of dumped all my responsibilities as best I could. You know, everybody, and especially writers, are working with your subconscious in some way. And I think what my subconscious was doing was saying, Orwell, he writes about things from the position of an underdog. He sees relationships of power for what they are. Mm. And maybe something in his watching him create or find his writing self through this development of from the first letters and essays right through will help me rediscover my writing persona and also look at it from the point of view of the underdog I felt I was in this situation and be able to identify the power relations that were working on me to make all of this domestic and care work, to make me feel it was my responsibility to do. I have a completely lovely and perfectly capable husband, but I was looking at this in a gendered way because we live in a gendered world, and I thought Orwell might be able to help me. I'm not sure that he did help me. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Yeah, well, there's some irony to it because you were looking for an understanding of how power works and, you know, by a literary genius who wrote about the way that power works in ways that really changed our thinking, you know, around various dynamics. And yet what you uncovered was a power dynamic that had not been written about, which had been swept under the carpet, which, of course, in itself is a power dynamic. Talk us through I guess how you discovered the story of George Orwell's wife, who had essentially been written out of history.
Yeah.
And as you do that, if you can just share some of the techniques that were used, you know, for that to happen.
Yes. There are two kind of shocking, it's a sort of double shock. One is to read your way through Orwell's work and find virtually no mention of his wife, particularly in Homage to Catalonia, a book about his experiences fighting as a newlywed in Spain. And you can read that book a couple of times as I had. And it's a fantastic book. It's visceral and funny and great non-fiction account of being in Spain. You can read it and not understand that his wife was there the whole time. And she was there working in a very important political job at the headquarters of the party he was fighting for. And he was literally off, bored out of his mind in a hole in the ground in the trenches.
Misbehaving. I mean, honestly, the way that you describe it, and you're referring to texts about his time there, written by others as well as by Orwell himself. I mean, he was a troublemaker. He was getting his fellow, you know, soldiers into trouble because he was that bored.
Yes, he was really bored. I think he was 6'2½, and he kept sticking his head up above the parapet or above the trench and
getting shot at.
I think he was so bored he was trying to find a bullet to hit him, and he was eventually successful. But in one of the examples of what happens in Spain, I'm kind of slightly getting into the detail before I talk about the overview, but you know, he does get shot in the neck, and he narrowly escapes death, as you do when you get shot through the neck. The bullet went in one side and out the other, and he spends 2,500 words in Homage to Catalonia describing what that felt like. His thoughts did go to his wife at that moment. He told a stretcher bearer.
And he doesn't mention her name, right?
He doesn't mention her name, and he doesn't put that in the book. But 2,500 words describing then being shunted about on the backs of trucks into various field hospitals and abysmal nursing care and this and that and the other. But he doesn't say, for instance, that within 48 hours, Eileen was there looking after him and managing all of that care. So he writes her out before anybody else does of his life and work. I read my way through his work, especially the essays and then Animal Farm in 1984. And then I read, in order to try and kind of cure myself of my middle-aged malaise, through these six biographies written by men of Orwell. And they go from the 70s right up until the early 2000s. And I guess that's the double shock. So you can read your way through his work. This is a man writing in the 30s, 40s and 50s. Well, 30s and 40s. But then the biographers are writing up until really recent times, and you can read all of those biographies and not really get a sense of who Eileen is at all. So the erasure is double. Orwell does it, but then it continues into our modern day. And I think you're talking about my insertion of myself in my books. I'm very reluctant to do that. I would much rather not be in them. But it seems to me that I need to do that sometimes to position the book in the present day. So with Stasiland, I had to do that to position the stories of East German resistance and East German collaboration in the 1990s when I was finding them, because the ex-Stasi agents and the ex-resistors were walking around the same streets and cafes and supermarkets, and I wanted to show what that was like and also my method of talking to them and finding them. So I had to use myself for that reason. And in this case, with wifedom, I've had to do a similar thing, but it's also a slightly more both emotional and political act, because I'm saying or asking the question, why does this erasure of a woman, in this case a brilliant Oxford-educated writing woman who saves Orwell's life at least once, probably twice, supports him financially, gives him the idea for Animal Farm as a novel, which they write together. She works in censorship and propaganda. She does all the domestic work, all the really hard physical work when they live on this kind of bizarre little hobby farm thing outside of London. So how is it that someone so unbelievably crucial to his work, who typed much of it and edited much of it and made it, as people say, some of the biographers say, for reasons we don't really understand, perhaps it was coincidence, possibly influence. His writing got much better after he got married. All of these things are written, and yet you have no sense of who she is. And so I wanted to look at the mechanisms by which women as mothers, in Orwell's case, wives, girlfriends, ex-girlfriends, aunts, was very important to him. All of these intellectual and incredibly important women, often left-wing and politically active, are turned into footnotes, left out altogether, trivialized or demeaned, so that it can look like two things. Orwell was a self-made genius who did it all alone, and also the way that he treated women. He was extremely unfaithful to Eileen, sometimes in ways that look like he was committing sexual assaults, really. Biographers describe him, or they describe something as the Orwell pounce. It's trivializing something that was very frightening if you were on the other side of that pounce. So what we've got is a man, Orwell himself, and then all of these biographers up to the present day who are reflecting a culture which I think we need to look at today, in which things are seen from the man's point of view so that he looks like, as I say, a self-made genius writer, and he also looks innocent of what he did to women. So if he can get rid of the women as victims or as very important mentors, patrons, helpers, intellectual lodestars, and so on, that's the only way to do it. And I actually think that is really fundamental to how patriarchy works. It's how men are central and innocent, and women are peripheral and yet working so hard to keep everything going.
I want to come back to that because I think it's such an interesting theme, and I completely understand why you needed to put your story in there. Also, as a mother of you know, a teenage daughter at the time who was challenging you on your own behaviour and attitudes, which I think is really interesting. But one of the techniques I think that is worth just fleshing out a little bit, sure, Eileen wasn't mentioned. The biographers also managed to kind of, you know, erase her from their versions of Orwell's story. But there was also this use of the passive voice, right, when it came to the details of Orwell's life. Can you describe how that worked?
Yes. So I guess circling back a little bit to your other question that I didn't quite answer properly, when I had read my way through Orwell and then through these biographies with great joy and interest and fascination as my kids went back to school that summer, then I came across six letters that had not been found. They were found after the biographies were written in 2005, and they were from Eileen to her best friend who had also read English at Oxford with her. Her best friend's name was Nora. And these letters go from the beginning of the marriage to the end of the marriage. And in the first of them, Eileen writes to Nora, "Dear Nora," it is 6 months after they've been married, and they've been living in this tiny hovel where they've been looking after goats. She's been looking after goats and chickens and cooking three meals a day. And there's no electricity. There's one cold tap. I mean, it's really, she comes from an upper middle class family and has been at Oxford, and she took it all on. I think she had a capacity for hard work that was sort of extraordinary. And I also think she was very curious about what he would write. She'd had a blow at Oxford to her confidence, where she thought she'd get a first and she hadn't got it. And I think she thought, well, I'll just, perhaps subliminally was thinking,
enable.
I will write through someone else. I'll see what can be written and then I'll take it from there. But that involved an enormous amount of all this other grunt work. She writes to Nora 6 months after the wedding, "I'm really sorry I haven't written to you earlier, but we have quarrelled so continuously and really bitterly since the wedding that I thought I'd just write one letter to everyone once the murder or separation was accomplished." I just thought that was so priceless. And I thought, who are you? You're hilarious. What are you fighting about as you're getting used to this new job as a wife? And why don't I know anything about you from these biographies? I turned back to the biographies, to the pages where they're just married. And so the biographers, who are seeing things naturally enough from Orwell's point of view, say things like, the early days of his marriage were the happiest of his life. He was never happier before or after. Conditions were idyllic for him. And that's when...
just magically.
Magically. That's when I think the penny dropped for me and I just thought, well, conditions were idyllic is the passive voice. Someone was making those conditions and she was working really hard to make them. And I think women in general work really hard in ways that are made invisible to make the conditions for the physical and emotional lives of families, children, parents, old people, cousins, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that really interested me. And when I then started to reread the biographies with this passive voice in mind, every time something was put in the passive, the baby was collected, the manuscript was typed.
The passports were organised.
The visas were obtained and so on. I was absolutely on the alert to think, which woman, at what cost, has done this thing that has been passive voiced away? And it was so fascinating to me.
Yeah. Once you alerted the reader to that, I started to notice it elsewhere in my life, you know, and I notice it within myself as well in the way that things get discussed. There's just an assumption that, you know, certain things do get done. And I picked up on it everywhere in everything I was reading, and it really did come up a lot. And I'm sure people listening to this will probably do the same now that they've heard you describe it that way. Going back to the biographers, you mentioned the fact that they refer to how his writing got much better after he got married. You know, again, in the passive voice, it just got better. I'm wondering to what extent Eileen did in fact contribute to his two most famous works, 1984 and Animal Farm. You mentioned the fact that she worked at the censorship department of the Ministry of Information, which, you know, during the war, I suppose, was just basically putting out fake information and deleting parts of history. And that was, you know, that was essentially her job. But yeah, I think, you know, you describe these scenes of her sitting in bed, particularly around with Animal Farm, kind of, you know, they were huddled together because it was cold. She'd been at work all day. She would come home and sit in bed and they would essentially write Animal Farm in particular together. But I think with 1984, even just the idea and the title, in fact, came from her.
Yes. So with Animal Farm, we have very good record of the, in a way, the writing of that book because Eileen, having worked in propaganda in the war in Spain, they came back to London. War broke out in London and London was being bombed, as we know, by Hitler. She had to work to support them financially because Orwell, she'd been undertaking a master's in psychology when she got married. And I suspect under some pressure from him, he was slightly anxious about this. He hadn't been to university at all and he was anxious about this higher qualification and of hers and wanted her to really be just working for him as a wife. And so she didn't complete that degree, but she was very skilled. And the theory of that in Orwell's mind was, I will support a wife. But of course, it's not how it is for many people.
And he wasn't great at holding down a job when he needed to during those sort of interim years in the war where people just had to earn some money.
No, he wasn't. He was working for small magazines and writing. I mean, he was working very hard on his writing, having, you know, lots of affairs with secretaries at little magazines or at the BBC where he then had a job. So he was busy.
nice use of the word busy. Yes.
But she did get this job at the Department of Censorship in the Ministry of Information. As you say, she would have been involved in, you know, deleting the news, much as Winston does in 1984, the novel, his last novel. She hated that job. And after that, she got a job at a place called the Ministry of Food so that she could support them. So she would work all day at the Ministry of Food, writing skits for the BBC to broadcast to teach the women of Britain how to feed their families on the rations of wartime. And Orwell at that time decided that he wanted to write an essay critical of Stalin. And with her very acute political nous and presumably her experience working in the Department of Censorship, she said to him, that will never fly. Stalin is currently on our side trying to win the war against Hitler and it will never be published. So I don't know exactly what the conversation was after that, except that what happened was he changed from going to write an essay critical of Stalin to writing Animal Farm, which is a book, it was, he thought, his best book. It is a book unlike any other book he ever wrote in form and tone.
Particularly because it actually details people or characters and personalities, which he was notoriously not good at.
Exactly, exactly. And female characters. Eileen had studied under Tolkien and she'd studied at Oxford and she'd studied fable and she knew all about animal fables and Aesop and everything. So she would work all day at the Ministry of Food, shop at lunchtime to try and find what she could, bring it home, cook dinner for whoever was bombed out or there and him. And then, as you say, they would hop into bed together because they couldn't afford to heat the flat, and work on the book. So they were looking at what he'd done that day and what he would do next. And every day she came into the Ministry of Food and regaled her friends with the next instalment. She said, I knew at once it was a winner. So to take nothing away from him, he's actually doing the work each day, but it is with intimate involvement with her. And then she's also typing it and editing it, as well as coming up with the form, the idea, presumably the female characters, because there are no decent female characters really in the rest of his work. So that's a pretty close account of her involvement. 1984 was written after the marriage was over, but she had written before she met Orwell a poem called 1984, The End of the Century. She wrote it in the early 30s, and it was projecting a future of, you know, dystopia and telepathic mind control and so on. So I don't know whether he remembered that when he was looking for a title for 1984, whether it was some kind of homage to her or whether he was thinking of that poem as he was writing it, or I don't know, but it's a curious date to pick out of nowhere.
It's very curious. And I think the ministry that she worked in, the actual building in Bloomsbury, wasn't that also the inspiration for, what was it called?
Senate House. Yeah, so she worked at Senate House, which is in Bloomsbury, which is a kind of ziggurat-shaped building. It's very distinctive. And then that is the model for the Ministry of Truth, which is where Winston works, the character in 1984, as he sits up there deleting the news, as she did. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's an influence.
Some involvement. I think when I was reading the book, because, you know, I read Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm when I was younger, and we're aware of just how pivotal he has been in discussions in and around power, particularly recently with sort of the surveillance stuff, particularly since that when Trump, I think, was first elected, it saw a revival in sales. I think it became a number one bestseller again. That's 1984, that is. But I think it's very unsettling to witness the hypocrisy, right? So here's a guy who has been committed to exposing power imbalances and the intricacies of the ways that power works and being very critical of it. And yet in his own life, there was an incredible power imbalance. And he actually used many of the techniques that he writes about to keep that imbalance in place. And it's actually a classic case of doublethink, which is a term that Orwell himself coined in 1984. Could you remind everybody of what doublethink is and how it works?
Yes. So doublethink in 1984 is the ability to hold two contradictory things in your mind at the same time, Orwell writes, and one of them is conscious and one of them has to remain just below the level of consciousness, because if it rose to the surface of consciousness, the contradiction between the two would reveal to you a sense of hypocrisy.
And a massive dissonance, yeah.
A massive dissonance. So if you think about that, it's an incredibly useful concept. And, you know, Orwell didn't get it out of the blue. There's a history of philosophy about these sorts of things and psychology, as you say, cognitive dissonance and so on. But if you think about it in terms of systems of power, say, I think that he first started to think about that when he was a policeman in Burma as a very young man, and he recognised, you have to give him full credit for this, this racist system of empire that the British were imposing on the Burmese based on this sort of perceived differences between the races. And he said he thought that the empire was a system of despotism with theft as its aim. So he sees that really clearly, and he sees that these white men who consider themselves to be decent blokes actually, you know, sit around in their club drinking whiskey, calling for the natives to be boiled in oil or whatever. So that dissonance between thinking that you're a decent, upstanding Englishman and then doing these shocking things on the basis of race is something that he can see. And I think that the idea of doublethink comes out of that. But what he can't see in another system, which is more ubiquitous, it is a system of the difference between the power imbalance between the genders and the gendered nature of work. He can't see that because, partly because in his age it was difficult to see, perhaps, and partly because he has too much to gain.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot,
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The second aspect to it, the double in that thinking concept, is that you've got to believe yourself to be a good person, a decent person. And so you can see that patriarchy often works to that end. And I think you say, you write that patriarchy is the ultimate double thing. And you write in the book, the whole world was set up to allow men to treat women badly and still think of themselves as decent people. To what extent do you feel that that is still at play today?
I think it is still at play today in ways that we should be thinking about quite carefully, because it's very constricting for women, but it's also constricting for men to be stuck in these sorts of gender norms. I'll just give you an example. So, because I'm talking about decency was a core Orwellian value, so it seems very apposite to be talking about that in relation to Orwell. When we say, for instance, just in a common conversation, a man is a decent bloke, we mean he's trustworthy. He's a person of his word. He's a man of integrity. He's the same inside and out, and so on. When we say a woman or a wife or a mother is a decent woman, wife, or mother, that comes with the work of care attached. So you cannot be a decent woman, a decent wife, a decent mother without doing the work of care for other people. Husbands, children, houses, relatives, and so on. Whereas you can be a decent bloke, there is no implication that you are doing the work of care for your elderly parents or small children or whatever. So I think that in that way, just that tiny linguistic example, we see how work is so closely attached to definitions of what it is to be a good person if you're a woman, work of care, and not if you're a man.
Yeah, I think it comes up, I'm just listening to you talk about that. I think another example of it is around, it's very pertinent to your book and what you've done with this book, is the idea of a man being exposed for being a misogynist for, you know, I think fairly good evidence to suggest that he was sexually assaulting women, the Orwellian pounce. And I think that there's this idea that, well, he was a good man. He was a decent man. He brought us all these ideas. He wrote wonderful books. He was a literary genius. And it comes up in a conversation around cancelling, right? I mean, it's very topical, has been for the last couple of years. These literary figures, these historical figures, who really, in many ways, their success was predicated on their lack of decency, if you dig beneath the surface. But they have this overlaying story of being decent, of being a good bloke, and so we shouldn't knock them down, you know, including their statues. And that comes up with this book, doesn't it? I know that you were very careful not to cancel George Orwell. And I think there's been some critics who've suggested that that's what you were trying to do. You're trying to cancel this great man who produced great work. I sort of want to do a slight segue here because it's sort of come up just now. But I'm really interested in your thoughts around cancelling, whether we should or we shouldn't, and whether there's a lot to be gained from not cancelling them and having these kinds of discussions instead.
I think that's exactly right. So it's some older kind of Orwell aficionados have, many men have written to me, actually, particularly from the UK, extraordinarily beautiful, also from Australia, actually. I had one amazing letter from a Tasmanian man. an Orwell fans and have written to me letters about their shock at finding out who he really was and at the fact that you can read biography after biography and not really understand this in the round. But there are some who would like to continue to believe in the fantasy of the decent man who did no woman any harm, so, and who owed nothing to women.
He might have had a few indiscretions, but, you know, men are like that. They've got to do that to be able to get on with their important work. You know, we've got to cast those ideas aside so that the bigger project is achieved.
Yes. Mm. So what a man does in terms of, you know, sleeping with his wife's best friend and then wanting to her to find out about that, to kind of isolate her, or, you know, reducing her, really. Over the course of the marriage, we see Eileen go from someone who deleted the word obey from her wedding vows to someone who doesn't think she's worth life-saving treatment. There has been very minimal kind of pushback, but it's the kind of pushback that just says, please don't give us any information about what he did to women in a way that makes it look like the women might not have wanted to be pounced on at parties and workplaces. And we want to think Eileen was happy all the time, that she willingly took on all this work, that she could have left any time, and so on. So they are continuing the narrative, which just says women are happy in their position, they are happy being treated this way, and therefore the man is innocent. And that's a very old-fashioned story, and it's actually the story that I'm looking at very closely and showing that that's not true. It's very interesting to me that to have the real story of what it was like for Eileen and what she said in her own words, and for me to be imagining what it was like for some of the other women in his life, seems to me very upsetting to those people who would like to continue this fantasy of this decent man. I was very worried about going into his private life, I have to say, in the beginning, and I thought, oh God, he would hate this. And I thought I would hate this too. And then I found some words he'd written in his last literary notebook in the third person where he says, the thing that they don't tell you about women and especially wives is about their disgusting filthiness and untidiness and their terrible, devouring sexuality. He said he thinks that in any marriage of more than a year's standing, it's always the woman who wants sex more and more and always despising her husband more and more for his lack of virility. Orwell only lived with one woman, Eileen. Yeah. And when I read that, I just thought, wow, what was it like for her?
You know?
And I'm guessing too much cleaning and not enough or not good enough sex. And so I went to have a look at that. So I'm not interested in cancelling him, but I'm very interested in having a much fuller picture of the man as he really was. And to do that, you have to look at how he treated his most important partner in life, which was his wife. So she can't be invisible. She can't be taken for granted. She can't be imagined to be happy when her letters say she wasn't, and so on. So there's a sense of
you make the watching. Point that she was cancelled.
She was.
You know.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think that the cancel kind of approach to things, I remember going through this when I quoted Louis C.K. in one of my books, and my American publisher was like, delete any mention of him, you know, because it's just too heated. It was right when he was going through those, you know, sexual assault allegations and or charges. And I made the argument, no. We acknowledge that he produced some great insights. And then we also refer to the fact that these charges were in place. Like when we cancel, both stories get erased.
Yes.
And we never have this kind of discussion where we are required to hold the complexities of our history and the multiple stories so that we can hopefully resolve it going forward.
Yes, I think that's right. And that is an exercise in a way of doublethink. And it is difficult because we're holding contradictory things. But it's our society that makes them contradictory. And it makes them contradictory so that in the case of patriarchy, men can look like they're doing everything alone, unaided, and that there are no victims of their centrality and power, you know. So if you look at, say, 1984, it's a book that we give our teenagers to read. It's a book that has in, you know, the first few pages a scene where Winston, the main character, angrily fantasizes about raping a woman and slitting her throat at the moment of climax. Mm. So we don't think about that book like that, but that's not the only scene of that kind in that book. But the book is paranoid, so it's imagining a dictatorship and a totalitarian state, unsurprising. It's violent. It's sadistic. We have all of the stuff with the violence and the rats in a kind of hyper attenuated way. And it's misogynist. And to think that it's still very useful to us. It's still, we live in an age of rising totalitarianisms. It's a really useful vision. And because of some of those qualities. So, but to imagine that that book was written by a man who was a vanilla, everyman, well-adjusted, quote-unquote decent, who did not draw from deep inside himself, as all writers do.
Because he's essentially Winston, isn't he, in 1984, this kind of victim. You know, he tends to cast himself as something as a victim, doesn't he?
Always.
Yeah.
He's always a sort of victim, everyman, underdog person. And that's coming from somewhere that's real. So it shouldn't really be a surprise to us with any writer, myself included, although I never put myself in the same sentence as Orwell, obviously. But it's a problem with readers, not with writers. We project the fact that, oh, we love this book and therefore we want to love the author and therefore we want the author to be beautiful person and worthy of our love.
Yeah.
And that's an unrealistic expectation because actually we want art of all kinds to show us difficult things, to move us in ways that are unexpected, to confront us and to put that all within a frame that is somehow manageable and also beautiful. That's what a big work of art is doing. And so to expect that to come from someone who's somehow a simple, decent, everyman bloke is unrealistic. So I think to have a picture of Eileen and the sort of behind the scenes in the marriage, the behind the scenes of the making of that work adds to
exactly
the picture of him and the work. It doesn't detract from it. But it has been very interesting to me to hear these few lone kind of old patriarchal wolves basically saying, please be quiet. We like the story of our fiction of Orwell as it was. Please shut up.
Perfectly double-thinkish.
Yes.
I'm wondering, because this book has come out in a number of different languages around the world. You've also lived in Paris, Berlin, New York, and you're back here in Australia now. Have I got this right? In part because your husband got work here, so the family moved back to Australia. So you will have spoken to all kinds of audiences and got feedback from both men and women around the world. Do you feel that there is a difference in the way that people in different parts of the world have received this book, particularly the themes around the role of women and the continuing presence of the patriarchy and the way that men's careers are enabled by wifedom?
Such a good question. So it is rolling out around the world in other languages, but I've only toured in the UK so far. Going to be in Paris, actually, your neck of the woods in September, and then other places to follow.
I actually got my copy of Wifedom, obviously in English, from Shakespeare and Co.
Oh, did you?
Our mutual friend Sam did, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a queue outside Shakespeare and Company last time I was there. It was lovely to see. Yeah, I think, well, the first thing to say is obviously, you know, patriarchy is planetary. There is no place on earth where we can escape it or where it doesn't exist. This system in which men have most of the power and money and leisure time compared to women. So that's just statistically true. And the UN estimates women are doing most of the unpaid work of care. If it had to be paid for, it would cost, according to the UN, $10.9 trillion US dollars
a
year.
I've heard that.
So that's a lot. So, you know, that's patriarchy is planetary. But it does feel different in different places to me. So it's a really subjective thing. I'm sure that the statistics would show varying things as well. In Australia, we have no public childcare from birth to school age. So that, and we have a punitive tax system that forces all women, including educated women who have had expensive educations, out of the workforce because childcare is extraordinarily expensive and the tax regime taxes couples so that often for a woman it's not worth working more than 3 days a week or at all because she'll lose money in the tax
system. That with France.
So France has universal crèches, so that's really quite different.
And the school system works, I think, such that it's in alignment with working hours. So it's, what, 9 till 5.30. The main meal of the day is catered for.
Exactly.
And, you know, my friends, it's like the kids come home, they have a light meal, so there's not that whole drudgery of making the evening meal. The parents spend time with the kids, quality time, because they're not caught up in, you know, the stress of everything. And it's also, isn't it also, there's a tax break attached to any childcare, babysitting even.
Yeah, I think it's very different. I think that's, they are huge, huge differences. You know, I got up this morning, I make my son a lunch, you know, I'm going to go home after I've done a day's work, I'm going to be making a hot dinner, or my husband's going to be making a hot dinner. It's true, all of that. Australia is, you know, really reliant on women essentially taking charge of doing that, either doing it or delegating.
Yeah.
It's a massive, massive thing.
It's interesting. I feel, and I've written about this a little bit, and I'll put links to the particular articles I've written on this, that there's almost a sort of a post-colonial mythology that's very, very tied up in particular ideas of masculinity. So it's this idea of the larrikin, easygoing bloke in Australia. And I feel that that plays in very well to this doublethink kind of mindset, because there's all kinds of atrocities that are committed under this bloke regime. You know, it'll be racial, it'll be sexual, and, you know, there's definitely a misogyny that exists in this country. But what makes it particularly problematic is the way that the larrikin mythology, oh, just be an easygoing bloke, don't want any drama. And if you put up your hand, and I've said this a couple of times in different forums, if you put up your hand as somebody who has suffered any kind of sexual inequality or racial inequality or otherwise, and you say, actually, I don't find all of this to be easygoing. This is not an easygoing country of U-Butte blokes and larrikins having a great old time and pulling each other up or ourselves up by bootstraps and you know, fair go for all. I actually don't find that to be the case. This kind of larrikin mythology then can turn around and go, oh, well, you're un-Australian. That's not what this is about. And I find that to be so, so doublethink, And it relies on the mythology of being a decent bloke at all costs. And it cannot be that buttressing around the misogyny that exists here. You're not allowed to question it or chip away at it. So I find it particularly potent here because there's no dialogue beyond that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Mm. It's quite hard for a woman to be a decent bloke. And if that's the only model there is. And you're right, it turns so quickly into victim blaming. What's the matter with you that you're not a larrikin bloke?
It's gaslighting. Yeah, yeah. It must be you're the problem if you don't fit into this, you know, this awesome culture of easygoingness, you know. And I think this happens around the world in the dating realm as well, but I see it happening particularly poorly here where, you know, sort of dating apps, the man will actually dictate that the woman must be easygoing. I don't want drama in my life. You know, that is a very common bio descriptor for a lot of Australian men. I don't see it elsewhere to the same extent, but that's
so interesting,
very prescriptive.
So that says, I don't want you to have an emotional life.
And if I cause any problems, like, for instance, if I ghost you or I don't reply to a message in our courtship, I don't want drama. I don't want you to actually hold me to account on that. And I will be able to put it on you that you're dramatic, you're problematic, hysterical.
Wow.
It's particularly potent here in Australia. And I've seen a bunch of articles, one written recently, I think, for either Vox or Vice, about how that's a very, very Australian male phenomenon.
That really goes to very fundamental set of power relations between men and women.
Mm.
I'm not on the dating scene, so I'm so fascinated.
Count yourself very, very lucky, Anna.
I am actually very lucky in my personal life. But I do think what you're describing is a really violent power play. It just says, I, the bloke, can dictate these things to you shamelessly.
Hmm. And I think it happens beyond male-female dynamics. I think it happens with different cultures and, you know, racial minorities and even sort of either political or philosophical positions. You know, if you don't fit the status quo, then it's a problem. You're not Australian. You are not fitting in with the dominant mindset. Anyway, that's an interesting one, and I was interested to see whether you'd had different reactions. But maybe once you start touring wifedom elsewhere in the world, maybe some of these particularities.
Well, it is true that in Australia I've had the reaction from women has been very emotional. You know, people say, I read this in 2 days, which always astonishes me because I'm such a slow reader. But, it makes me very happy because it's actually quite a big book. But and I devour it, and they look at me. Sometimes they're sort of tearful, sometimes they're relieved, sometimes there's quite a lot of laughter in the gigs that I'm doing, spontaneous kind of clapping, and it's kind of comes at these sort of feminist moments of discussion. Whereas in the UK, I suppose naturally enough, they you know, that's Orwell's home base, but there were many more men in the audience and the discussion was much more around Orwell and possibly less around Eileen or less around the women's issues. I'm just speaking very generally.
Yeah. I think, I mean, there's a lot of discussion here in Australia around, you know, sort of the prevalence of WhatsApp groups amongst wives and mothers talking about these themes, you know, and I find that an interesting phenomenon. We could go in all directions.
There's a lot of that. And I think that this book is being taken up by, like, you know, lots and lots of those sorts of groups and book groups and everything.
Yeah.
And it's almost, sometimes I get this sense that it's almost like the book is recognizing a dynamic that has been unspoken and unspeakable and almost taboo. So it's as if I'm going to, you know, create havoc within marriages or something, which is not the case at all. But I don't think that the issue of women just by our gender automatically being expected to, you know, organise the medical care and the Christmas dinner and the orthodontics and the vet and the shopping and the, either you have to do it or you have to delegate it, which goes to show, or you have to, you know, bring it up in discussion with your male partner. So it goes to show that that work is yours to either do or delegate. And I just don't think that this problem can be solved one marital discussion at a time. We need, like the French have, wide social measures. So society just says, we have this extraordinary, you know, we're half women and these women are being kept back. And what do they need? They need subsidised childcare in the same way as we have subsidised schools and hot lunches in the middle of the day and very excellent aftercare and, you know.
And.
So
they've thought it through. Yeah. It's really interesting that you're book comes out at the moment, but it also comes off the back of a recent revival of 1984. So sort of the post-Trump election a number of years back saw the book go to a number one bestseller once again. And it's, you know, the book's obviously about the doublethink, surveillance, the weaponization of language, censorship, all of that is happening again. And I find it interesting that while we're seen a revival of an interest in books like 1984, at the same time we're and you know, there's a bunch of books that sort of, you know, everybody's sort of buying again, trying to understand. I remember there was a New Yorker cartoon where they had, you know, sort of Orwell's books, Margaret Atwood's books, and they were changing it from fiction to non-fiction at the top, you know, as the category in the bookshop or the library. But it's interesting because we're just as engrossed and trapped in these ideologies and so on as ever, in fact, even more so, which is doublethink, right, personified, because we're not willing to see our own behaviour in it. We think that, you know, we're criticising these structures, but we're in it, and we buy the book, but we still don't even get the message. And I'm wondering, you know, you've studied Orwell's work in a lot of detail over the years. How does this worry you, the fact that this doublethink is really at play at the moment in the world?
I think that we're talking about systems of tyranny, so the unjust use of power. And it's true that democracy is under threat in many places in the world. Mm. And if Trump gets in the way that it exists in America, it will be under threat there as well.
I think 90% of current democratic nations around the world will experience a decline in democracy this year, because I think half the world is going to an election. And we're speaking right now as Russia's results have come in. And what do you know? Putin's been swept back to power. But yes, there's going to be a massive decline.
Yes, I'm very interested in systems of power. My husband said to me actually about this book, or in general, what is it about you? First of all, you take on the Stasi, so that was a totalitarian dictatorship. Then you take on the Nazis in my novel, All That I Am, and now patriarchy. And he kind of looked at me and said, are you done? And if you're looking at systems of power and representing them between the covers of a book that's hopefully and a bizarrely enjoyable experience, you are identifying how they work in order that we see it more clearly, to resist it, to avoid it, you know, to vote against it, and to safeguard our democracy such as it works. But these systems of power are not just totalitarian politics, either, you know, black, right-wing or red, left-wing. They are also, as you say, racist, and they're also gender-based. And I think, you know, it's really important to look at them and kind of pull them apart. You know, Gloria Steinem said, I think she might have been paraphrasing someone, she said, you know, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off.
Yeah.
And I don't want to write things that piss people off, but I certainly do want to write things that are, obviously they're works of art in some way, but they are also meant to be liberatory. That's why they have this deep connection into the real world. So you're absolutely right. We live in an age of rising totalitarianism and blanket surveillance. And for that reason, 1984 is important and prescient, because it allows us to see those things so clearly.
As is your book. And I think of those women on the WhatsApp groups and in the audiences who sort of laugh that nervous laughter of recognition. I think often we need to be provided with the language to be able to take these ideas out to each other, and maybe out to institutions, workplaces, husbands, brothers, whatever it might be, sons. And so I think that's super important. And plays back to that idea of not cancelling these figures and their stories, because we do need to keep talking about them and finding language that gets the message across in a way that's productive. I know that you were asked in an interview somewhere in the world while you were doing the publicity circuit for this book, what is the one thing you'd like a reader to take away from reading your book? And you said, claim your pronoun. What do you mean by that?
It's not done in our society for women to talk about and make visible all the work that we do to keep everybody going, families and children and parents and all the rest of it. So we don't say, when I organise the holiday, when I organise the school change, when I organise Christmas dinner, when I organise the Airbnb, when I, whatever it is. It's, we did this and we did that and we did the other
thing. So we play into the passive voice technique.
A little. So it's, even if it's just in, I find it enormously hard to do, because I'm married to this lovely man who does a lot, and it always feels churlish of me. So I find it really hard to do. But I do think, as a thought exercise, if not actually doing it, just to claim I is to make all of that work of care visible.
Yeah, it's interesting. I came across that quote, and then I was flicking through Instagram, such is my life, my devotionary techniques. But Katharine Hepburn, there was a meme, and it was a little video excerpt from some interview she did many, many years ago. And the interviewer, the journalist, was saying, oh, so, you know, how do you go about just doing what you do? You know, you're wearing pants. And Katharine says, well, I've worked out how men do things, and then I just go and do it without asking permission. If I asked for permission, it probably wouldn't work out this way. And I think the journalist said something like, oh, and do you own a skirt? And she said, yes, I own one. I'll wear it to your funeral if you like. But I think that idea of claiming your pronoun, taking ownership of what you're actually doing,
so you can see it,
so the world can see it, is really important. And we can probably learn, and this is not about reflecting on where men might be going wrong, it's about where women can learn from men, you know, and to place a stake. Language is important, and placing a stake in this territory so that things are pretty clear from the outset is so important. I think it's a really good point you raise.
I think it is important. These letters, some of the absolute loveliest letters I've had are from older men looking back on their lives who've picked up my book, presumably because they're Orwell fans or something. I don't know how attractive
they are. Well, not also like your previous books.
Maybe.
Claim it.
Yes, I know. I should claim it. Well, Australia's a hard country to claim anything in those ways. But, yeah, they write saying, you know, I'm shocked when I look back on my relationships in my life. What was I blind to? They ask themselves. What didn't I see? Is that imbalance? It sort of rings bells to them. They think, oh God, is that what my ex-partner or ex-wife was saying to me? Is that why it didn't work? I mean, I think there's something liberating for men as well to be able to be A, deeply, deeply involved with their children in a way where they have total responsibility. I used to go away on tour when my children were small and Craig would look after them, and he was totally involved with them anyway, but he just said, when you're not here, it's completely different because I'm at work and I'm on call and I know there's no fallback. And that made his, not his actual emotional relationship, but it made his understanding of what it is to look after children and what it is to be solely responsible for them really different. I think men have stuff to gain out of this as well, not least that they won't be writing letters in 40 years' time to someone like me saying, oh God, what didn't I see that was going on in my relationship?
Yep. So, yeah, I think staking our story, staking our pronoun is a way for the story, for the language to be out there to enable all of us to be truthful and interact with each other better.
And also, how bad would it feel to think at the end of your life, I've had all of the benefit of this work of someone, another human being that she just did for me. I didn't ask. I didn't thank her. It was just society told her she had to do it, as well as working for money, as well as all the other things that she was doing. A decent person would not want to know about that and also wouldn't want to engage in
that. They don't want that dissonance on their deathbed. They probably need to confront it now. Yeah, I agree with you. And I think you do see that with a lot of men who wind up on their own in latter years. It's not always a very happy existence, because they haven't had the language to discuss these kinds of complexities. I've got one final question. I heard somewhere or read somewhere that it took you 7 years to write this book, and I know that you've used the word, I'm slightly embarrassed by that. I also took 7 years to write one of my books, First We Make the Beast Beautiful. The thing is about wifedom is the format is complex, and you've had to use some very tricky techniques to actually make your point, to rewrite Eileen back into history. And you've had to do that by owning your own agency in that, because otherwise you would have been slaughtered by the critics for just kind of, you know, inserting it without apology or awareness. I would just love if you could share with listeners how you go about writing a book and how do you stay with a book that is that kind of tricky, right? I haven't seen too many books written in this particular way before. You were inventing a technique. And that can be really scary because you don't know how it's going to be received. And to spend 7 years on it and live in that, you know, sort of uncertainty must have been really difficult. So how do you go about it? How do you stay on task?
Yeah, it was really, really hard. It was really frightening. And it was frightening really until it came out on, you know. And even after it came out, it was. I wrote the book in this way. When I'm writing a book, I look at my books have all had sort of links to the real world, to sort of real history. So Stasiland is nonfiction, and so is Wifedom in a way, mostly, although it has fictional bits. And All That I Am is a novel, but it was based on real people and events. And I feel like I owe the people who I'm writing about some kind of, I owe them a lot. So I owe them the best I can do at telling the truth. And that is going to take a different method each time. So Stasiland, I could have written a novel about a resistor, and that just wasn't the right way to go because no one would believe what happened in that dictatorship, that, you know, the Stasi stole your underwear and bottled it and all this stuff. Or the courage of the people involved is sort of unbelievable as well, although it's real. So I wanted that book to sit as an intervention in history. No one was telling those stories. They're still not really telling those stories 30-something years later, and that book did and does. And All That I Am, everyone was dead. No one told the story of this earliest Jewish resistance, this very erudite, upper middle class Berlin intellectuals who were resisting and possibly killed in London, never told. And this one, I had to do three things. And again, it makes me feel like it sounded like I know what I was doing. I didn't. I had to look at all the biographies. I had to tell the story of George and Eileen in a basic way that people could understand. And then I had to show how that story and that woman had been disappeared from history in the biographies. So that's the discussion of the passive voice and so on. And then I had these letters, which were such treasures, and I got permission to use them. So I knew where Eileen was when she wrote each of them to her best friend. So she's writing from within this marriage to her best friend. I knew what she was not telling Nora. She's not telling Nora that Orwell's off pouncing on someone, to use the biographer's euphemism, or sleeping with someone else because he's told her that that's what he's going to do, or that she's bleeding, or that she's ill. So I can be sort of in her mind. The fictional parts are indented, so you know very clearly that this is a fictional scene, but I get to use the real letters. So she's writing these letters to Nora. So that was an enormous technical risk, because to combine a non-fiction narrative and a kind of biographical narrative and a feminist critique of a previous biographical narratives in a way, plus this really visceral, funny, wonderful work of making scenes with Eileen's real letters, it was just unbelievably hard. And I did it because I wanted the work to do all of the things that we've been talking about. I wanted it to show who she was, how she's been erased, and bring her back to life in fiction. So I just did the best I could in those things. I will never write anything like this again. I will never. It's got 40 pages of notes. I will never.
You say that, but I say it every single time. I go, I'm going to write one of those really straightforward books that's just a singular topic and a singular approach, and I seem incapable of it. You tackle power structures, and they're always going to be complex and require being looked at from different angles, and use different techniques that disrupt. You know, they have to necessarily disrupt. And I write about complex things that people don't want to talk about, and I talk about them outside of the normal discussion. And again, you've got to use different techniques that make you believable. And I think as women, we feel that we've got to actually use a technique that isn't about us being a didactic expert, talking from above. Like, we're not allowed to do that. I know I've got to constantly write in how this is my lived experience. I experience it, and then I'm allowed to plant it on the page, because only because I've been there, and I'm just going to help you out and corral the information. Do you feel that pressure to have those techniques to be legit, to be treated as a legit writer who's, you know, putting something out into the world?
That's so interesting that you should say that. I mean, I imagine I am desperate to go and read your books now, which I should have already, but I imagine it makes your books very accessible to people and very kind of warm. And that writing persona is much more interesting and intimate and credible in a way than a writing persona that is neutral, all-knowing.
Authoritative, yeah.
Yeah, it's not so credible these days.
But it takes 7 years, doesn't it? Because you've got to live it out. You've got to live it out to be able to write it. Because you did. You went to Spain. You literally followed in the footsteps. Yeah. I think you've said you spent more time in Spain than Eileen and George did, you know.
Look, not actually in Spain. So I did go to the trenches, and I did with Orwell's son and the son of his commander.
We spent more time writing about
writing because I had to unpick Homage to Catalonia. I had to reverse engineer this book to see her behind it and then find all of these sources that the biographers hadn't looked at or had left out or had only partially quoted.
Mm. You were working with crumbs.
I was working with crumbs, and I had to make a huge cake, many-tiered cake, just to do justice to Eileen, really, and to, well, all women in a way. For me, writing is about asking questions more than pretending that I have answers, and that is a much more creative or fluid or humble or risky position to inhabit. I like that much more. I don't. But I think it probably is gendered exactly as you say. I hadn't thought about it before.
Yeah. To your husband's question, you know, you've written about these other different power structures. Are you tackling another one have you got another book on the horizon?
No, I think
what are you interested in?
The parts of where I was writing Eileen back into being were unbelievably easy to write and pleasurable and, you know, less so the 40 pages of endnotes. I think if you're going to take on patriarchy, six biographers, hordes of ancient frightening Orwellians, you need endnotes to tie it all in to say this is actually true, this is actually what he did, this is actually what he said,
yep,
this is actually who was left out, this is actually the source that the biographer could have looked at. Eileen actually said George has a remarkable political simplicity and not, as one biographer said, George has a remarkable political sympathy. You know, just doing all of that detective work. My husband said I was like Carrie in Homeland, like completely obsessed and crazy.
Yep.
And looking for the missing
person. Did you have things pinned to the wall?
I had endless.
I do the same.
Endless stuff. It's very exciting to do, but I don't want to do that again. I think there are other things that I can say now in a more condensed form in fiction, and I don't think I'm going to do this again. But, you know, as you say, famous last words.
Yeah, well, bravo. Bravo for doing that. And I am sorry that, you know, as a woman, you feel that you've got to have all of this proof to make a point, you know, and notes per argument. And I did notice it. It didn't go unacknowledged or unnoticed or unappreciated. So I think a lot of readers would be aware of just that amount of care. And it makes it very believable, you know.
If you're going to take on an icon, you have to. I didn't want to take on an icon, you know, of course, it wasn't my MO, but I just realised, I don't want to be in eternal arguments with people about this. I'm showing things that are true. So if you're worried about whether it's true or not, there's no numbers.
Here you go.
Just go on.
I did the same. I took mine offline. I can't remember how many endnotes it was, but I had to take it out of the book and put it into a PDF online with hyperlinks to make it even easier for people. And I just point them in that direction if they want to argue with me.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And I thank you so much for this conversation. I could keep on going, particularly in and around your writing technique. I do hope you write another book, because I think the fact that you go there, you couldn't help it. It was an exploration that was very real, and I think it reflects a very real exploration that a lot of women are going through. So thank you very much for your time.
Such a pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
I very much recommend heading out and getting a copy of and reading Wifedom, and I'll put a link for buying it in the show notes. The themes in the book raise a lot of relevant stuff to today, including our complicity in the patriarchal system. It was actually quite funny to witness both Anna and I contributing incursions to this extent in the interview itself by not claiming our pronouns on several occasions. But also the challenge of the way that Anna writes the book is interesting to observe. And the fact that it was written at all, I think it exposes doublethink in a whole range of ways. That is, where there are two contradictory truths, one of them generally an indecent behaviour, the other being a mythology of decency that has to be maintained in order to do the indecent things. Doublethink is everywhere, and as we cover in this conversation, the best we can do to unravel it is to expose it, to have a language around it, to develop skills in holding two thoughts openly, you know, to practice this, to actually get very familiar with it. Because as Anna says, things in the rear vision mirror are closer than they appear. Our society, Anna says, is built on the unpaid or underpaid work of women. An estimated, was it $10.9 trillion per year? And the patriarchy would fall apart without this. And women are silenced, gaslit, told it could never be any other way. What do you want, socialism? It's that kind of thing that we generally get greeted with in order to keep this going. And we normalise male achievement and genius and supremacy around all of this. I am so, so grateful to writers and thinkers like Anna that do spend 7 years on a hard problem like this, who insist on exposing these kinds of problems, putting their story up for consumption, who create the way of writing and presenting information to expose the deception indoctrination techniques that abound. Some wild things to think about there. And if you have any suggestions for guests going forward, the best place to send your suggestions is over at my Substack, and the link is in the show notes at sarahwilson.substack.com. And you can just post your suggestion in the latest
comments, you know, that's attached to the latest post. That's fine. I do read all of them, all of the comments as they come in. I look forward to hearing your suggestions. Until then, please do stay wild.